In this hour of midday, two guests with fascinating stories from the final days of World War II. The conflict ended 70 years ago in late summer 1945 when atomic bombs destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, forcing Japan to surrender. Our first guest, Edgar Harrell, was a young Marine who survived 4 days floating at sea in a life jacket without food or water after Japanese torpedoes sank the cruiser Indianapolis, a story famously told by Robert Shaw's Quint in Steven Spielberg's movie Jaws. Later, we'll hear the story of Army Sergeant Anthony Marchione, the last American to die in combat. Stories from the final days of World War II on Midday After the News. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. In the late summer of 1945, Japan's surrender in World War II ended the bloodiest conflict in human history. More than 60 million people died worldwide. And later in this hour of the show, we'll hear a sad but fascinating story about the last American to die in combat in that war. But first, we talk with a survivor of the Navy's most costly single disaster at sea, the sinking of the cruiser Indianapolis. Edgar Harrell, a Marine assigned to the Indianapolis, is among a handful of surviving crew members. The disaster began July 30, 1945, when a Japanese submarine fired 2 torpedoes that ripped the ship apart, just a few days after the Indianapolis had delivered the atomic bomb's components to American forces on Tinian Island. The Indianapolis sank in 12 minutes, before the crew could launch lifeboats. Its distress calls went unheard or ignored. 300 men went down with the ship, leaving more than 800 men struggling in a toxic oil slick and heavy seas. They kept from drowning only by their life jackets. Unaware the ship was lost, even after it failed to reach port on time, the Navy never dispatched the rescuers the crew expected. For 4.5 days, Edgar Harrell and his crewmates suffered from dehydration, sunburn, hypothermia, saltwater poisoning, and shark attacks. One by one, they slipped away until a routine patrol spotted the exhausted survivors. By that time, only 317 were left alive. Edgar Harrell describes their courage, suffering, the faith in God that kept him alive, and the Navy's attempts to cover up its failings in a compelling book called Out of the Depths, available from Bethany House Publishers, an unforgettable World War II story of survival, courage, and the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. After the war, Mr. Harrell became a lay minister, a successful distributor of storm doors in Illinois, and a board member of the Moody Bible Institute. His son and co-author, David Harrell, is the senior pastor teacher of Calvary Bible Church in Joelton, Tennessee. Mr. Harrell, welcome to the Midday Show here at WYPR, and thank you for making time for us. Mr. Harrell?
Sir, don't hear your question.
Okay, Mr. Harrell, I just wanted to say hello to you and thank you for being
Hello, it's an honor to be on your program, sir.
Yeah, thank you for making time for us, Mr. Harrell. So, where do we begin? I wanted to begin a little bit with you and how you became a Marine. Where did you grow up, and when did you become a Marine and get aboard the Indianapolis?
Okay, I grew up in Kentucky and volunteered for the Marine Corps, San Diego boot camp, they sent me to sea school, and then after sea school, I knew I would be seagoing, so I go to San Francisco, and there was the big USS Indianapolis, and I would be aboard the Indianapolis for the duration of the war.
It was a heavy cruiser, right?
That's right, sir.
And the Indianapolis had this assignment of delivering atomic bomb components to Tinian.
That's right. And I was a Marine Guard after Okinawa, and we were in the States, and we had a secret cargo coming aboard, and 10 days later we had delivered something we didn't know what we were guarding, delivered that to our B-29 base on Tinian Island, and a few days after that, then we were going on to the Philippines for the main invasion of Japan, and we encountered a Jap sub, and Commander Hoshimoto fired a spread of 6 torpedoes. 2 hit us, and the ship went down in 12 minutes, and the rest is the story of the sinking of the Indianapolis. But then our secret cargo then was dropped at Hiroshima and Nagasaki on the 6th and 9th of August.
Mr. Harrell, I need to ask you this question. Everyone knows or has been told through history that the atomic bomb was a top secret project. No one knew this was going to happen. So take me back to that summer. Was there any talk other than of an invasion of Japan? Did anyone think the war was going to end any other way? Do you remember the talk?
Right. At the time, President Truman could continue with the firebombing or to try to have a peaceful settlement with Japan, or for us to land, and we would have landed 2 million troops. Britain would have landed 1 million with us, or his fourth option was to use the atomic bomb, which we didn't really know whether how successful it might be. But then we dropped the first one then at Hiroshima, and then 3 days later at Nagasaki, and a few days after that, then the Japanese were aboard the Missouri.
It's for the surrender. Of course, you knew none of this because right away, because the Indianapolis sank in about, I have it as about 12 minutes or so. Is that correct?
Right. The ship went down about 12 minutes, and there were 1,197 of us aboard. We surmised that maybe 900 of us got in the water, which meant that about 300 didn't even get off the ship. Of those that got in the water, though, the Navy lost us, and we literally swam with the sharks for 4.5 days. And at the end of that time, when we providentially were spotted, there were only 317 of us still alive to be rescued. Of that number, there are 31 of us still living today. So all of us are that 90, 91 years old.
God bless you, Edgar Harrell. Edgar Harrell was a 19-year-old Marine at the time that we're talking about here aboard the Indianapolis. Now, a lot of people know the Indianapolis story from the telling of it by Quint, the character played by Robert Shaw in Steven Spielberg's Jaws from 40 years ago, 1975 film, and Quint tells the story aboard the Orca with Richard Dreyfuss and Roy Scheider listening, and it's a gripping moment in the film when Quint, played by Robert Shaw, describes being in the water with sharks.
You know the thing about a shark? He's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, doesn't seem to be living until he bites you, and those black eyes roll over white, and then, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in, and they rip you to pieces. You know, by the end of that first dawn, lost 100 men. I don't know how many sharks, maybe 1,000. I don't know how many men, they average 6 an hour. On Thursday morning, Chief, I bumped into a friend of mine, Herbie Robinson from Cleveland. Baseball player, bosun's mate. I thought he was asleep. Reached over to wake him up. Bobbed up and down in the water. It was like a kind of top. Upended. Well, he'd been bitten in half below the waist. Noon the fifth day, Mr. Hooper, Lockheed Ventura. So as he swung in low and he saw us, he was a young pilot, a lot younger than Mr. Hooper anyway. He saw us and he come in low, and 3 hours later, a big fat PBY comes down and start to pick us up. You know, that was the time I was most frightened, waiting for my turn. I'll never put on a life jacket again. So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
A Quint, played by Robert Shaw from Jaws. This is the Midday Show in Baltimore. Dan Roderick speaking with Edgar Harrell, a real survivor of the Indianapolis disaster, author of Out of the Depths, a book written with his son David Harrell, an unforgettable World War II story of survival, courage, and the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. And Mr. Harrell, you've seen that scene from Jaws. You've listened to that story from the movie.
Oh, yes, I've seen that. And the only difference being that he was not actually there. He did a wonderful job in portraying the fact that he was a survivor. The only difference was I was out there. I was one of the survivors.
Yeah, I know that. I want to read something from your book. I'm going to read it for our listeners and for you again, and then you can comment on it. It says, you're talking about being in the water here. To keep us all together through the massive crests of waves, our dwindling little group formed a circle and fastened our life jackets to one another. Those who didn't have a jacket hung on to someone who did. Our bodies in the open sea, we began to realize that the sun was transitioning from friend to foe. It soon blistered our previously chilled and now exposed flesh. We tore our clothing to make protective hoods, but the ultraviolet rays reflecting off the water still managed to find our skin. The bright glare forced us to squint our eyes until our facial muscles became utterly exhausted. Our eyes also burned from the caustic saltwater waves that constantly splashed in our faces. Late on the first day, around dusk, we had company. To our horror, we saw several large black dorsal fins cutting through the water and circling the group. I cannot describe the fear. So, Mr. Harrell, take us back to that time when you were in that group with those other men, and you remember being in that circle with the life jackets all attached. Did most of those men in that group survive the 4.5 days with you?
No, I was in a group of about 80. We lost several the first night. Some did not have life jackets. Some were injured. But by the third day at noon, there were only 17 of us. And then our Kapok jackets, you know, won't last forever. And that's all that we had in our whole group. I never saw a life raft. And we did not have a floater net. We only had life jackets. And after the third day, when there was only 17, we take off our life jackets and we turn them upside down and we sit in them. They have the same buoyancy, the only thing they're a little lower in the water, and your head is sticking out of the water a little more, but you have to keep swimming, 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 or else you're going to pitch in the water. And, of course, we're losing boys up till that third day, and we had a struggle then. It's a long story of the things that happened the third day and the fourth day, but actually I was picked up with one other Navy lieutenant at the end of the fourth day. And to my knowledge, through the years, there's only one of those 17 that ever survived the Indianapolis.
One of the 17 that remained out of that group. Is that what you mean?
Yes, of the 17, there were only two of us that ever survived that group.
Wow. Men died from, some men died from dehydration, some men from...
Hypothermia. You know, at night it's 85 degrees, but the water is about 85, and you're out soaking wet and you're in the wind, and if you don't have on some clothing, then your body temperature is going to drop a degree or two every hour. And if it gets down to 84 degrees, hypothermia sets in, and there's no way that you make it. Then in the daytime, it's 110 degrees. You're bareheaded, and you're swimming nearly constantly. And so we're losing boys just ever a little bit. I tell the story in my book, Out of the Depth, of how I, together with the 317, survived those 4.5 days.
Now, this is very important to you, the role of faith, God, and Jesus in your book, because this is a very important part of the book to you, so I wanted to ask you about that, because I was about to ask you how you survived Ed Harrell. So please talk about that a little bit.
Well, as I say, I speak all over the country, and I have to be honest and say that it was not the fact that I was a Marine or a good swimmer, nothing of that sort, but it had to be a higher power looking over me and watching over me and not allowing me to be devoured by a shark, because I saw boys disemboweled or the bottom torso gone, or maybe hear a blood-curdling scream, and you look and you see that capon jacket goes under, but then like a fish cork, it comes to the surface, and you dare not to go and check your buddy because of all the blood and the sharks. But later, maybe you check your buddy and you find out the bottom torso is gone or he's disemboweled. So, you just look up and thank the Lord. And I often say that there's no such thing as an atheist in foxholes, and there were no atheists out there. I can hear this one sailor now as he poured his heart out to the God that he thought he knew. God, if you're out there, I don't want to die. I've got a son back home I've never seen, but we have to have help or we aren't going to make it. And then the second day, when our tongues are swelling in our mouth and we're so thirsty and we know that we can't make it without water, then to have a little rain cloud to come over and then to open your mouth heavenward and pray just to get a few tablespoons of that good fresh water. That's all the water that I had for 4.5 days in 110-degree weather.
Mr. Harrell, do you remember when you saw the flying boat come in, the PBY?
Oh, yes. Of course, I saw the plane that spotted us first, and as Lieutenant Gwynn and that Ventura, I called it a B-25, a twin-engine plane with wheels on it. Here he's flying up about 4,000 feet, and he's having trouble with his radio antenna, and he tells the co-pilot to take over, and he goes aft and opens a bomb bay door and looks down, and what does he see? He saw the oil on the water down below. He thought that would be a submarine down there, and he rushes back to take over control of the plane, and he announces to the crew, load the bombs. And they loaded the bombs, and they come in on a bombing run. We think that he has seen us, that he's coming in because he saw us, but impossible for him to see us. Here, he's flying up, say, 4,000 feet. He's looking farther to him, say, 4 miles. He's looking out his peripheral vision, 2.5 miles each side, looking at 20 square mile, and to see a man's head down there 6 by 8 inches, impossible, impossible. But I have to say that in the providence of God, he saw the oil slick on the water. He comes in with his bombs loaded, preparing to bomb a Japanese sub, but when he gets down under that 2,000 feet, then he sees sharks attacking boys, and then he goes up then over 4,000 feet to radio back to his base in Palau. He gets in touch with Adrian Marks, a pilot of a PBY, and Marks comes on the scene an hour and a half, 150 mile later, and he asked permission to do an open sea landing, and they tell him no way, but he and the crew argue the point that there are boys down there being mauled by sharks, and he did a no-no. He landed that big PBY against the rules, and he picked up 56 of us. I'm one of the 56.
Edgar Harrell is our guest, a survivor of the USS Indianapolis. So, Mr. Harrell, in the time remaining, I wanted to ask you about the captain of your ship, Charles Butler McVeigh III, the only case in which a Navy captain was court-martialed for losing his ship, the Indianapolis. So please talk about him, what happened to him, and how the survivors of the Indianapolis came to his support many years later.
Okay. Immediately after the ship was sunk, and we saw that we were not reported from Sinpak and Guam to the Philippine frontier. The Philippine frontier did not receive us, and yet they knew that once we got halfway, we would be turned over to them. And now we sent out SOSs, and those SOSs were ignored. Now, it was a miscarriage of justice 100% on the part of the Navy, and we tried to prove that, but no one wanted to go in opposition to the Navy. So it took us 50 years, and we stood by Captain McVeigh, knowing that he was innocent. In fact, I was his orderly, and at the first reunion, I wrote him a letter and invited him to come to our first reunion. But he was hesitant because of the 880 didn't make it. They thought that he was the guilty guy because of their loved ones not surviving. But after 50 years, the archives were open, and we saw we had a little boy, little Hunter Scott down in Florida that saw the movie Jaws. And because of that, he came and joined our group every reunion that we had. And then after 50 years, we had sufficient evidence that we go before the Armed Services Committee in Washington, D.C., and we got our good captain exonerated finally.
Just to background that a little bit more for our folks, Captain McVeigh was accused by the Navy of not being on full battle alert because he was not on full battle alert because he had been told that the area was free of Japanese naval forces. And as I said, it was the only case in which a Navy captain was court-martialed for losing his ship. The crew and many others considered the court-martial a travesty, as Mr. Harrell has said, and the survivors spent 50 years trying to clear his name and purge the conviction, a move that I would say, I should note, was opposed by the Navy. Ultimately, Captain McVeigh was absolved in a congressional resolution during the Clinton administration, and that was what the law allowed, all that the law allowed at that time. So, Mr. Harrell, I thank you for being with us today. And before you go, I just wanted to ask you about thinking back 70 years to this. I know you've told this story many times, and now you and your son have written a book about it. I held on to this book from last summer because I wanted to talk to you about it this summer, which is 70 years. And, you know, aside from having this sort of nightmarish memory of that, of those events at the end of the war, What is the lasting good memory, you would say, about all this experience and the men you knew back then?
I didn't get your question, sir.
I said, you know, what good memory do you pull away from your time at the end there? And or what lesson have you taken with you through life when you talk to people about your experience on the Indianapolis?
Well, I've been in some 33 states, and I have a full schedule the rest of this year of telling of God's providence of the 317 of the 1197, of which 31 of us are still living today. We just had a reunion celebrating our 70th anniversary now of the sinking of the Indianapolis, and it's an honor to be on your program today, sir.
Well, it's an honor to have you, Mr. Harrell. Thank you very much for telling some of this story. And I'll tell folks, if they want to read more, your book on this is Out of the Depths, an Unforgettable World War II Story of Survival, Courage, and the Sinking of the USS Indianapolis. It's published by Bethany House, an imprint of the Baker Publishing Group. Thank you, Mr. Harrell.
Thank you so kindly, sir.
Edgar,
it's an honor. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Edgar Harrell, a survivor, one of the few remaining survivors. I think he said 31. From the U.S. Indianapolis. So please stay with us, folks, here on the Midday Show. When we come back, another story from the final days of World War II. Last to Die, a Defeated Empire, a Forgotten Mission, and the Last American Killed in World War II. welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Well, no soldier wants to be the last one to die in a war, but someone inevitably is, and our next guest tells the little-known tale of the last man to die in World War II combat. Actually, it was 3 days after Japan announced its surrender. Sergeant Anthony Marchione was a likable 19-year-old from Pottstown, Pennsylvania. He was a photographer's assistant assigned to the crew of a new trouble-plagued B-32 bomber flying reconnaissance missions over Tokyo to make sure Japanese forces were complying with the ceasefire. Stephen Harding tells the rest of this story in the book, and he's going to spend some time with us today. The book, Last to Die, A Defeated Empire, A Forgotten Mission, and the Last American Killed in World War II. Stephen Harding is a military affairs journalist, longtime military affairs journalist, and editor-in-chief of Military History Magazine. He's written several other books. This one, again, The Last to Die, from DeCapo Press. Stephen Harding, welcome to Midday here on WYPR.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I wonder if we could just take a minute here and kind of lay the historical landscape of the spring, summer, 1945, before we get into the story of Anthony Marchione. Just to give folks some understanding about where the country was at that time. Of course, we had the European surrender in the spring of 1945. But would you take us through the summer and toward the end of summer of that year?
Sure. Well, as I'm sure your listeners will remember, the Japanese had been rolled back through the Pacific from about midway on. And by July of 1945, U.S. And Allied forces were arrayed throughout the South Pacific, the Southwest Pacific, and the North Pacific, as well as in Southeast Asia, and they were bombing Japan literally into submission. In August 1945, if you remember, there were two atomic bombs dropped on Japan. The first was on Hiroshima on August 6th, and then Nagasaki 3 days later on August 9th. Now, Emperor Hirohito, for several reasons, one of which, obviously, he was horrified by the destruction that had been that had been visited on his country, and also to a certain extent, he wanted to find a way to preserve the Japanese monarchy. He went against literally hundreds, if not thousands, of years of Japanese tradition and accepted the Allied ceasefire terms that had been put forward during the Potsdam conference earlier. And in so doing, he literally horrified all of his senior leaders. There was a huge controversy about whether Japan should surrender. But he persevered, and on August 15th, 1945, pre-recorded broadcast of Emperor Hirohito telling his people that they had to accept the unacceptable. And he never actually said the word surrender, but the gist of his radio announcement was that Japan was going to surrender to the Allies. It was a stunning shock to the Japanese people. Thousands of people killed themselves. People were shamed. And it was also, of course, the first time that most Japanese had ever heard the voice of the emperor, who was considered a god at that point. So that's sort of where it was in mid-August of 1945.
How did you get to the story of Anthony Marchione? And I want to make sure I pronounce it the way his family did. It's Marchione. Some may pronounce it Marchione, some just Marchione.
Yeah, in Italian it would be Marchione, mm-hmm. but the family in Pennsylvania says Marchione, so I've chosen to sort of accept that pronunciation. I first came across the story of Tony and the B-32 over 30 years ago. I was working as a journalist in San Diego at that time, and I wrote, co-wrote with a gentleman named Jim Long, a very thin little book about this obscure American bomber of World War II called the B-32 Dominator. As you may know, Dan, the B-32 was a contemporary of the better-known B-29, and I personally think it was a better aircraft in many ways, but it was plagued by engineering problems, you know, unfortunate things like engine fires in flight and landing gear that would not come down when it was supposed to. So whereas there were thousands of B-29s built during World War II and for a short time afterwards, there were only 118 B-32s ever built.
Well, you said there, Stephen, as you may know, Dan, actually, I was a little surprised to see B-32 and thought maybe in my notes it was a typo at first. No, I really didn't know anything about it.
It's about as obscure an airplane of World War II as you can find. And because there were only 118 built, and most of which never even left the continental United States, only a handful made it to the Pacific. And the only reason that happened was because George Kenney, who was the commander of the Far East Air Forces, had wanted B-29s because all of the B-29s that were bombing Japan were in the northern Pacific, flying from the Marianas or from China. And he did not have access to B-29s, so he took what was available, and this was the B-32. So he brought a handful of them to the Philippines initially, where they carried out 11 test missions, bombing various Japanese targets from different altitudes and using different kinds of munitions. And then in early August 1945, these aircraft, which were part of the 386th Bomb Group, bomb squadron of the 312th Bomb Group, they moved to an airfield on Okinawa called Yontan. And they were carrying out anti-shipping sweeps. They bombed a couple of targets. And then on August 15th, with Hirohito's acceptance of the ceasefire, they stood down. Now, when I first told this story in the small book, which, believe it or not, is actually still in print many, many, many years later, Tony's story was just one of those things that just sort of hooks you. As a journalist, and you'll know this, Dan, I mean, there are certain things just really kind of grab your attention or your imagination or your empathy. And I thought for many years while I was doing other jobs and various other places that someday I would like to tell his story, because we know all the big stories of World War II. And of course, as your previous guest talking about the Indianapolis, many of them are just horrific. Well, here in Tony's story, we had sort of the summation of the entire war. He was one of only, you know, several hundred thousand Americans killed in action or died of wounds or injuries or sickness, for that matter. But because he was the last American killed in combat before the actual surrender of Japan, he was in many ways just a footnote in the history of World War II. But I wanted to be able to make him a real person, because as you mentioned in your intro, you know, nobody wants to be the last person killed in any conflict. And Tony certainly didn't go looking for that dubious distinction, but it found him. So I spent many years sort of digging away. I was able to locate over the course of probably a decade all of those surviving crew members of the various aircraft involved, some of the senior commanders involved. I scoured the archives. I found everything I could find. And, of course, in recording the interviews, I had these increasingly older gentlemen remembering things that would literally make them cry on tape. And this is, you know, 35, 40 years after the event. Sadly, they're gone now. And so, in a way, the recordings that I have of their interviews are the last real link to what could have been one of the most momentous actions of World War II.
Well, we're going to take a little break here and come back and hear some more about Anthony or Tony Marchione from Stephen Harding, author of the book that we're discussing in this segment of our show as we look back to the final days of World War II, Last to Die, Stephen Harding's book, A Defeated Empire, A Forgotten Mission, and The Last American Killed in World War II. DeCapo is the publisher. More on Anthony Tony Marchione when we get back. Some time ago on this program and in my column in the Baltimore Sun, I told the story of Henry Gunther of Baltimore, the last man to die in World War I. He was from the Patterson Park area of Baltimore, and he had the tragic distinction of dying on the final day of World War I. Today we're telling the story of the last combat death of World War II, Anthony Tony Marchione, told in the book by our guest Stephen Harding. Last to Die, A Defeated Empire, A Forgotten Mission, and The Last American Killed in World War II. So let's talk a little bit more about Tony Marchione, Stephen. I mentioned that he was from Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Who was he? What was his family like? And what were his ambitions in life?
He was the only son of three children of Ralph and Amelia Marchione, who were Italian immigrants. Ralph was a shoemaker, and Amelia was a homemaker. And he was, by all accounts, sort of the all-American boy. He's remembered by everyone who ever knew him as just a really nice guy, and he was very talented. He was a musician. He was a poet. He was a very good watercolorist. He was really a very art-oriented kid, but he also really wanted to be a pilot. Now, when he graduated from high school, of course, at that time, when young men graduated from high school, they were drafted pretty much almost immediately because the war effort was still in gear. And he decided that he would sort of beat the rush, and he enlisted in November 1943. He enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Forces. He initially wanted to be a pilot, but sadly for him, he wasn't able to follow that route. And he ended up going to the course for what was called flexible aerial gunnery. Now, anybody who's ever seen 12 O'Clock High or Memphis Belle will remember the scenes of gunners dressed in fur-lined outfits standing in open waist windows of B-17s or B-24s firing at enemy airplanes. Well, that's what Tony trained to do, although he did it in the Pacific and he rarely had to wear any sort of fur-lined garment. He and his crew were initially a B-24 bomber crew. And ironically, they were initially scheduled to be sent to Italy. But at the last moment, his crew was pulled out and retrained as an aerial reconnaissance crew. Now, they flew essentially the same sort of airplane. It was instead of being called a B-24, it was called an F-7. But it was essentially a B-24 that was fitted with cameras rather than bombs. His best friends were two other gunners. One was a kid named Rudy Nudo. And the other one was Frank Pallone, who, just by way of explanation, is the father of Congressman Frank Pallone of New Jersey. Hmm. But these three Italian-American kids were very good friends. When their unit deployed, they went to the Philippines initially as part of the 20th Combat Mapping Squadron, and they flew several missions photographing Japanese installations in the Philippines. And then their unit also moved to Yontan in Okinawa. And by the time they got there, everybody in the unit, not to mention everybody in the United States, assumed that the war was almost over. And on August 14th, Tony and everyone else were literally just expecting peace to break out at any moment.
We have to reestablish the bombs had already dropped, the two atomic bombs, August 6th and August 9th. And then when we get to August 15th, we hear the announcement from the emperor, right?
Exactly. And a few days before that announcement, Tony made what, obviously in retrospect, was probably the worst decision of his life. He volunteered to fly on a reconnaissance mission that was going to be flown by the B-32s of the 386th Bomb Squadron. General MacArthur, obviously, who was the commander of all Pacific forces, had decided to send B-32s over various parts of the Kanto Plain, which is the area around metropolitan Tokyo, essentially to check the fidelity of the Japanese, to make sure that they were actually carrying out the ceasefire mission. And the B-32, whatever people thought of it as a bomber, was actually a very stable flying platform. It worked. When things worked, they worked very well. So he assigned these B-32s to fly over Tokyo, and Tony volunteered to go along as a helper to one of the aerial photographers, a friend of his named Joe Lackerite. And the reason he volunteered, at the end of World War II, and this happened in Europe and in the Pacific, one of the ways they determined who went home when was how many points you had, and you acquired points by flying combat missions or, you know, the number of hours you had in the air. And Tony wanted to get home. He had big plans. He was going to go home and be a professional musician or something. And so he volunteered to go on this flight. The first of the B-32 reconnaissance flights over Tokyo took place on August 16th, when several of the B-32s flew over Tokyo, took pictures, were not bothered in any way, came back to Okinawa. On the 17th, four more B-32s were sent over Tokyo, and they ran into trouble. They were fired on by anti-aircraft batteries, and they were attacked by Japanese fighter planes. Now, a quick digression here, Dan. Most of the Japanese forces, and remember, there were still some 2 million Japanese troops under arms on August 15th. Japan had been battered, but she still had a number of forces that she could have used to resist any invasion of the home islands. So most of the troops did what their emperor told them to do. They stood down. But there were two significant groups that didn't, and they were both in the Tokyo area, and they were both fighter squadrons of the Imperial Japanese Navy. One was called the 302nd Air Group at a place called Atsugi, which many of your listeners may remember from having been there after the war. And there was the Yokosuka Air Group, which was based at Opama Airfield near the city of Yokosuka. Both of these squadrons were made up of some of the best surviving fighter pilots Japan had ever produced. They were highly competent, they were aggressive, but they differed in one important way. The 302nd guys at Atsugi were just whipped into a Bushido never-surrender frenzy by their commander, a guy named Captain Kozono, who was just outraged about the idea of surrender. So he worked his men up to a frenzy that they weren't going to surrender. They were going to attack any Allied forces they saw. Over at Atsugi, it was a completely different thing because the aviators there were willing to accept the surrender, but they also made a point among themselves that until the surrender, Japan was a sovereign nation, and it had the right to protect itself. And so they sort of agreed among themselves that if Tokyo looked as if it were going to be attacked, they would attack the attackers. So the scene was sort of set at that point for a very, very bad confrontation.
And which group intercepted the B-32 in which Tony Marchione was?
It actually was mainly the Yokosuka Air Group, which contained people like Saburo Sakai, a very famous Japanese ace, and a gentleman named Sadamu Komaki. But there were also pilots from the 302nd, and there may actually have also been a few Japanese Army Air Force pilots who had refused to surrender. So after the August 17th mission was attacked, nobody was injured, MacArthur had a decision to make. He needed to know whether that attack constituted the Japanese essentially reneging on their surrender offer, or if it was just the work of some, you know, hotheads. And unfortunately, senior military commanders often have to make that decision of sending people into harm's way, essentially to find out what the situation is. So on August 18th, 1945, four B-32s departed from Okinawa. A few hours after takeoff, two of them had to turn back because of the gremlins that have always bothered the B-32, mechanical issues. So the two remaining B-32s droned on to Tokyo. And one thing we should mention here, on both the August 6th and August 9th atomic bombing missions, the things that Japanese observers saw, if they saw anything before the bombs hit, was two very large American bombers with tall single tails flying essentially together. So on August 18th, when Japanese radar picked up two high-flying American aircraft, the logical assumption that some people made was that it was another atomic bombing raid. They did not know that we had no more available atomic weapons. And they might well have assumed that we were about to sneak a bomb into Tokyo. And Tokyo would have obviously been the target of any third atomic bomb.
So the plane that Anthony Marchione was on was attacked, and he was wounded.
He was. It was a very interesting and very fast-moving sequence of events. When the aircraft that he was on and the other one were flying actually several miles apart because they had begun their reconnaissance sort of mowing the lawn flight pattern so the cameras could pick up more territory. They were hit by multiple Japanese fighters, and Joe Lackerite, the photographer, was standing on one side of the aircraft because the camera, as it turned out, was not fully operable. both Tony and Joe were trying to call out the incoming fighters for the gunners on the aircraft. And Joe was hit suddenly by multiple machine gun bullets in the legs. It took him years after that to even get to the point where he could walk again. And he went down, and Tony turned around and lifted him up. And Tony wasn't a big guy. He was probably 5'6 and 120 pounds. But he lifted Joe Lacquerite up, and he put him on a sort of a fold-out settee, and he started to apply tourniquets to his wounded legs. And at that point, as he was kneeling there taking care of Joe Lacquerite, a 20-millimeter cannon round punched a hole the size of your fist through the side of the airplane and hit him squarely in the chest.
Mortally wounded, Tony Marchione bled to death in the arms of a third crewman. How do we know? We're short of time now, Steve.
I'm sorry.
But how do we know that that was the last combat casualty of the war?
Because it was so recorded by the Army Air Forces. Obviously, a lot of people died between August 18th and September 2nd, which was the official end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But they were dying of previous wounds or of truck, you know, rollovers or
infection.
Sickness. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. We just have a couple minutes left here. I want to tell the whole story from your book anyway. Where is Anthony Marchione buried? Can you tell us about when he came home?
Yeah, he was interred on Okinawa, and he stayed there for 4 years, and then his remains were finally repatriated, and he's buried in Pottstown. And I was able to spend time with both of his younger sisters, who delightfully are still with us. But his death, for them, it's like it took place yesterday. I mean, it's still very painful for them.
Well, it's a fascinating history, especially the reaction by the Japanese military to the announcement from Hirohito on August 15th. Some that chose to stand down as the emperor had asked them to. Others decided to keep on fighting, especially these naval aviators. One of whom was responsible for the death of Anthony Marchione 3 days after the announcement from Hirohito.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. And the family appreciates what you've done here, Steve?
They do. I hope that I've been able to tell Tony's story in a way that will not cause them too much pain, because for years they did not know the exact circumstances of his death.
Mm. Well, Steve, thank you very much for telling at least some of this story today. About in remembering Anthony Marchione, the last casualty of World War II, told in this book by Stephen Harding, his eighth or ninth book now.
It depends on how you count them.
Yeah. Well, I know you had one, The Last Battle, which was a bestseller. That was about the end of the European War, right?
Yeah, it was about the only time that American and German soldiers fought together, and it's on the verge of being a motion picture.
Well, good for you. That's called The Last Battle. This book is Last to Die, A Defeated Empire, A Forgotten Mission, and The Last American Killed in World War II, the story of Anthony Marchione of Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Stephen Harding has been our guest here. Thank you, Stephen.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our midday for today. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back for more. Again, Stephen Harding, the author of 8 previous books, the one I mentioned, The Last Battle, and this one, The Last to Die. We'll have another program, I think, soon about World War II, the last days of that war 70 years ago. Thank you for tuning in. Have a great afternoon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Samantha Max, Beatrix Lockwood, and Max Bookdahl. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.